Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. It's your Director of Public Affairs, John Vocat. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, this morning we're going to open with an encore play of a chat we did with Goodwill earlier in the year about the stuff you have piling up around your house. Summer is almost here, and the space you can make donating your unwanted and unused stuff to Goodwill to pass on to those who want and need that stuff can help fund important programs and put folks with disabilities and other challenges to work. So stick around and we'll tell you all about it. Then we're going to touch base with a research scientist from UConn in the Mystic Aquarium. June is National Ocean Month, so we'll talk about our connections to and our concerns about Long Island Sound and how everyone in Connecticut can help be better stewards of our sound and the global ocean network it's connected to. And if you are or hoping to become a small business owner, we're going to close replaying a visit with the leader of Connecticut's Small Business Development Center. He's going to explain how the agency's statewide network of offices can help quarterback small businesses to greater success with game-changing support, guidance, and resources. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vocat, right after this reminder. For the first time ever, Girl Scouts has introduced an extended year membership opportunity for new members. Both girls and adults who have not joined Girl Scouts before can register for a 16-month, $35 prorated membership that allows them to begin scouting during the summer, then transition right into the traditional troop experience in the fall. That's nearly 16 months of membership versus 12 for one low promotional price. This is a great opportunity for girls to enjoy all the thrills of Girl Scout camp and start right back with a troop in the fall. It's also a fantastic way for volunteers who want to start a new troop to beat the rush and get set up, trained, and ready to dive right into all the exciting programs and leadership building experiences that Girl Scouts has to offer. Register today and join the best leadership experience for girls by visiting gsofct.org. Well, it's so great to be starting off the program this morning with actual people in the studio and not at the end of the phone. Not that I don't love my phone guests, but it's great when folks are actually here and we can talk, and especially when they're from such an important organization to the award-winning For the People, which is our friends at Goodwill. And I'm so pleased to make the acquaintance of Shayna Holleran, who's here with us in the studio. She's a district manager for Goodwill, and they reached out to our program and our radio stations recently because of the need for stuff. You've got stuff hanging around. You don't want it anymore. Goodwill needs stuff, and they're making it really easy to connect to that stuff that you want to get rid of that they need. So we're going to talk all about that today with Shayna. But first, we want to hear, briefly chatting with her before we went on the air, she kind of made what appears to be a really logical and beneficial transition from big box retail to nonprofit. Shayna, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Welcome. Thank you.
So so tell us a little bit about yourself and how you took the experience that you gained working in retail to really boost the great work that Goodwill is doing.
All right. So I work for Goodwill. I'm a district manager there. I travel in between the stores just as offering support to the stores, ensure they have what they need to keep our donors satisfied, our customers satisfied. Working at Walmart, you know, I sold a lot of product. I sold a lot of things. I was able to really see what people need and what people pay for things. So I take that knowledge over to Goodwill and give it even a better deal to our consumers.
Mm. We kind of joked that, you know, stuff that you may have ended up actually literally selling to somebody back in that career may actually become before you or your workforce again.
So sure. I see a ton of things come through that maybe were this big item, you know, years ago, and then now they come through the doors, and it's like, wow, I remember selling this. I remember people waiting in line to buy this item. Cool.
That's great. Well, first of all, I guess the most important question to ask is why donate aside from, you know, kind of giving people a place to take stuff that they don't want anymore. Where does it go? Why does it go there? And what does it do once it's there?
Sure. You know, when we accept a donation at Goodwill, we're able to put a value on it, put it on our sales floor and sell it. So one aspect is we have our customers that come in to buy that product. They're getting a great value for that item. So they're paying, you know, half or less of what you would pay for when you go to a regular big box retail store. And then the sale of that items, those proceeds are going to help us support our mission. We're really trying to help people in the state of Connecticut find work and find jobs. So when you buy an item, we're able to take that money and support our career centers that are out there in our stores to help people find jobs, write resumes, improve on their interviewing skills.
And it's not just programming that you're supporting. There are actual opportunities for these individuals, possibly even to work their very first job at these centers.
Absolutely. And we employ 30 to 50 retail associates in every store that we have. And the store numbers keep on growing and our number of employees keeps on growing.
Tell me a little bit about the morale that you see, because you kind of, you drift around and go from place to place and you can kind of gauge morale in one place versus the other. Whenever I go to a Goodwill store or interact with Goodwill programming, I find most of the folks are pretty upbeat and excited to be there.
Absolutely. You know, it really shows that we love what we do. When you walk in, people are happy, smiling, and you can just tell that we're working for something that's just bigger than ourselves.
Mm. And how about from the customer perspective, bringing in folks like yourself with the kind of experience that you have? I have to imagine organizationally, overall, you may even hear occasionally from customers about how this is just like a shopping experience in a $1 billion big box.
Absolutely. Especially we have a few new stores that we've opened in the past couple of years, and you walk in and it's screaming, you know, the style of the store, the layout of the store. It's like a regular retail store that you would walk into. So our customers are usually really excited about that. You know, we have fitting rooms, we have restrooms, we have well-organized departments.
And the product line is, I know that many people think of Goodwill first when they think of donating things. And there are specific types of items that Goodwill needs more than others. But as you mentioned sort of before, we're not going to really talk about what you don't want, because essentially there's a customer out there for virtually anything somebody may want to get rid of.
Sure. I can't tell you how much I've learned just by being at Goodwill. You see this stuff come in, you have no idea what it is or what it's for, and then you meet that customer that wants to buy it, and they'll tell you exactly what it does and the reason behind it. So you'll find just about anything that you're looking for at a Goodwill.
Yeah. As 10 people are kind of standing there scratching their heads going, what the heck is that? Somebody's walking up behind you, literally breaking into tears because there it is.
Absolutely. That happens all the time.
Great. Well, tell us a little bit. There are things that you would prefer to have, and I guess now kind of post-holiday season when a lot of people may have gotten, especially like housewares and household goods, as a gift, or they decided, oh, they're going to, you know, beef up their microwave or their toaster or their vacuum cleaner, and now they've got the old standby that's now just sitting in a closet, right?
Sure. You know, all the time we'll take clothes, we'll take shoes, we'll take purses. This particular time of the year, and especially now, we're a little short in the houseware section. So we're just looking for, like you mentioned, coffee pots, microwaves, toasters, glassware, dishes. If over the holiday season you've redone your kitchen and you have some things that you don't need anymore, we'd love to have it down at Goodwill. We could really use that hard good stuff.
How about in terms of size or scope? I mean, do you guys actually want to take things like dishwashers and stoves and refrigerators?
Typically, we don't do major appliances.
Oh, okay. So kind of countertop appliances,
yes,
and things like that?
Yes.
Super. Good. Let's talk about how you make it really easy for folks. I heard there's drive-up service.
All of our Goodwill stores and donation centers have drive-thrus. So when you pull up, the folks inside are notified there's a car there. They come out to help you. We usually bring a cart outside to help you unload that product from your car. Real quick and easy. We'll have a receipt ready for you. It's a real simple process.
And how do folks find out where their closest location is?
So you can go on our website, gwct.org. We have over 30 places to make a donation. So I'm sure if you live in the northern and western part of the state, you'll find one really close to you.
And we kind of touched upon it, but like this is really a much more logical and kind of communally beneficial way to deal with stuff that you don't want anymore versus maybe just having a tag sale or something like that.
Absolutely. I always tell people when you make a donation, it is not ending up in a landfill somewhere. It's ending up in a store to resell. It's likely that maybe your neighbor down the road might be coming in to buy that item that you don't need anymore. So it's ending up back in a household, back in someone's house is maybe their favorite item.
Excellent. Tell us a little bit about how you factor pricing. This stuff is sometimes coming to you virtually, I guess even on occasion, in the box that it may have come in from the store. Maybe it even wasn't used. Other times it's gently used. How do you deal with that in either judging how you're pricing things? You said most things are half or less than they would have to get it in new in retail. Can you talk a little bit about how you gauge that stuff and how you prep stuff that's a little bit more used for the sales floor?
So there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes at Goodwill. When we get a donation in, we're doing our best to make sure it's in sellable condition. So we have a process that we go through, whether it entails a little bit of cleaning and scrubbing to get that product ready for the sales floor. And then when it comes down to pricing, we really have some standard prices that we use in our stores. So if you go from one store to the next, you really should still be able to find that drinking glass for $1 from one store to the other store. And then, you know, we get our unique items in that, the ones I talked about that you might not know what it is until you've actually used it somewhere in your future. But when we get those items in, we really do our best to put a great value on it. We want to make sure the customers feel the value side of it. And then when it goes out to the floor, we want to make sure it's nice and clean and ready for the consumer.
And does stuff that comes in that may look really in good shape, but you know, once you test it, you find it's not in perfect working order. Do you have the facility to actually kind of refurbish that for the sales floor, or does that unfortunately have to get?
You know what? You'd be surprised how many people are looking for items that for pieces or parts, right?
Oh,
so
I see.
Let's say
you
have a coffee pot, you're looking for that one piece that maybe broke on yours. So sometimes we will sell something maybe without all the working pieces because we realize there is a market for that. But we're always very clear about it. Hey, you know, you're buying this, but it might be lacking something. So we're always pretty clear. We do plug things in. We have some light bulbs and batteries to test it out and make sure it's in working order for our customers.
No, I never thought of Goodwill as a haven for tinkerers or individuals who service appliances and furnishings and things like that. So that's great. Well, before we wrap up with you, Shayna Halloran, tell me a little bit about where people can go and when you accept donations at these various locations across Connecticut.
We have awesome hours in our donation center. So a lot of centers are opened Monday through Saturday from 9 to 7. Our stores really have great hours, our donation centers. Most store locations, you could donate between 8 a.m. and 9 p.m. Monday through Saturday. On Sundays, we're a little bit shorter, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. Again, check out our website, gwct.org. You'll find really specific hours and locations. And we don't require any call ahead or any appointment. Just feel free to drive up. We'll have someone there to help you and come outside to collect your donations.
Excellent. And is there a facility for an individual who may be actually liquidating like an entire estate or an entire home on behalf of maybe a relative who has passed or moved or something, relocated? Is there still some availability for them if they have enough stuff to be able to get it picked up?
We do have that assistance available on our website too. If you went to gwct.org, there is a place there to let us know that it's something larger, an estate sale, a big moving sale, and someone will contact you directly about that kind of pickup.
Excellent. Shayna Halloran, our newest friend here at the award-winning For the People. She's district manager for Goodwill. Today, Goodwill of Western and Northern Connecticut has an urgent need for household items. As you heard, furniture, small appliances, glassware, and other wares. When you donate to Goodwill, your items go on to be treasured by someone else, even someone who may want it for parts. And it helps to put people back to work and help those folks who are engaged in Goodwill at the service end of of things achieve more independence. We appreciate you guys coming out today. And don't forget, if you have some stuff and you really want to put it to good work in its next life, you can go to gwct.org to get hours and locations, find out about pickups or when you can drop it all off. Thanks, Shana, for being part of the program this morning. Well, anyone who is experiencing this week's heat is probably longing to head to the water where it's a little bit cooler. They could take a nice cool dip in the ocean into Long Island Sound. It's interesting that we're at this place at this time and meeting a brand new friend to the award-winning For the People. We had a couple of great conversations already offline with Dr. Peter Oster. He's a senior research scientist for the Mystic Aquarium, and he's also a research professor for the Department of Marine Sciences at UConn. And coincidentally, June is National Ocean Month, so it's a good time to talk about our connections to and our concerns about, and Peter's connections and his scientific community's concerns about Long Island Sound and the global ocean network it connects to. So, Peter, thanks for joining us. Here we are, National Ocean Month. Now, I guess my first question would be, is this a companion to a global ocean month, or is National Ocean Month something that is celebrated globally in each nation?
Well, so yeah, indeed, this is a global national month of the ocean, and June 8th was a global World Ocean Day. The president declared June to be National Ocean Month here in the United States, so there's been lots of activities and outreach to people all across the nation on their connections to the ocean.
And if I understand correctly, from a scientific standpoint, there is a rapidly growing concern, as there has been for some time, because we talk about Long Island Sound and its global connections and how it's really kind of a unique little engine and a critical component to the well-being of the global ocean network. Talking about climate change and some of the issues that climate change is bringing to not only Long Island Sound, but the way it influences and sort of impacts the rest of the world.
Yeah, indeed, climate change isn't just an issue for tropical shallow coral reefs or for polar ecosystems. It's happening here in Long Island Sound as well, and our adjacent continental shelf. The composition of fishes that are in Long Island Sound is changing. We're shifting from species that are generally centered in colder climates farther to our north, and those moving up the coast from the south. We've traditionally harvested natural resources from the sea, and our economy has been, economies especially early in human settlement here, has been built around those. The challenge now is how do we manage use of these organisms sustainably, accounting for how, the challenge now is how do we use these sustainably, accounting for the normal effects of nature, the effects of fishing, changes in land use, and now we need to pile on rapid climate change and how that affects what we thought previously was normal.
Mm-hmm.
We generally, are focused on a small number of species for food and recreation, animals like bluefish and winter flounder, beasts like that. And now changes to these populations are noticeable. But there are over 1,400 species that live in Long Island Sound and over 3,300 species that live off the adjacent continental shelf. And we have stewardship responsibilities for the rest of this biodiversity as well. So while managing for sustainable fisheries is an important issue, we just can't hope that everything else falls into place under this management regime alone.
Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in how much influence that scientists have when decisions are made either locally, nationally, or even globally about how industries like fishing you know, sort of readjust to, say, you know, at one point there's 1,000 different fleets that are going out for cod, and then cod begins to get depleted. And I'm just saying this as a hypothetical example. So, you know, a third of that fleet needs to readjust to flounder or bluefish or lobster or seaweed, kelp. Does science and commerce work together at all, never mind as good as it should, in helping to expedite these shifts in the commercial end of things, to be able to, you know, sort of turn the Titanic, if you will, excuse the pun, up there at Mystic?
Yes, certainly. So, yes, well, you know, there are scientists that are involved in the process of understanding how populations of animals like cod are changing, and in developing alternatives for management. You know, but the science side essentially tells us what our alternatives are and what the potential outcomes are from those that we might choose. But then there, you know, there's social and economic factors that are added to the decision making, and ultimately the decisions are made by fisher. Well, it depends on what level we're at. At the state level, it's through Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. Mm-hmm. At the regional level, it's through the New England Fishery Management Council or the Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Council. And on the high seas, there are various treaty organizations that manage fishery resources. But there's always this tension between the economics of what we need to do tomorrow to keep industries viable, not just the boats, but the processing plants on shore and the distributors and the businesses that are on the receiving end of those products, and what might be the most expeditious choice that we need for rapid recovery of populations. So it's a tough seat to sit in to make these kinds of decisions, and you know, it's been tough to do.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the improvising, if you will, to ensure supply for those whose livelihoods and families depend on the bounty of the ocean, we've also seen, obviously much more advanced maybe in Europe and the UK, but I'm hearing a lot more about these concentrated fish farms, really sequestered areas of the ocean that are essentially closed off so that contractors can utilize those areas to raise and develop specific types of fish for the food industry.
Sure. I mean, here in the United States, aquaculture is becoming a larger and larger part of the seafood that people see in the market. Mm-hmm. You know, indeed, here in Long Island Sound, the oyster culture industry is huge. And the products from Long Island Sound go all over the world. You know, that's essentially mariculture by, you know, manipulating the environment and moving the shellfish around, oysters, quahogs, scallops, species like that. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and where these industries take place, where these activities take place, is based on another set of management regimes. Mm-hmm. here in the Sound, and in a growing aquaculture industry offshore in federal waters. You know, new here in Long Island Sound is the culture of kelp as a product that goes into both, you know, directly for consumers as well as into other food processes like carrageenan that goes into ice cream that makes it smooth and creamy.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a growing part of industry. Really, globally, we've essentially topped out on the wild harvest, hunting of wild fish populations.
Mm-hmm.
But there's certainly, you know, especially in many nations, there's room for improvement. You know, you used cod as an example earlier in our conversation. It, you know, this is the species that essentially built our nation, and right now is at a historic low point. And you know, in addition to warming temperatures, you know, continued, you know, and despite draconian catch restrictions, you know, whether these populations will recover or not remains to be seen. You know, we're essentially trying to produce forecasts, you know, 1, 2, 3 years down the road in a system that's very complicated, not just by trying to forecast environmental conditions, but how different species interact in terms of predator-prey relationships, competitive interactions, those kinds of things. So it's a very complex and difficult. Well, it's a very complex endeavor with high degrees of uncertainty.
Mm. Well, we're going. Go ahead.
Oh, well, I was going to say, but you know, we also have, you know, in order to understand what the ocean might look like in the absence of various types of human activities, you know, off our coast, about 180 miles from here, we have the only marine national monument in U.S. waters. The Northeast Canyons and Seamounts Marine National Monument, which is along the southern edge of Georgia's Bank, where submarine canyons cut into the edge of our continental shelf, and four seamounts, essentially extinct underwater volcanoes that are within our 200-mile zone, that in 2016 were declared a marine national monument, and all commercial activities were excluded in the proclamation that designated that area, although red crab, trap fishing for red crabs and for lobsters were given a 7-year grace period to leave that area. So here's this place that we can be able to compare and contrast areas that are being used for various activities with one that is not. And then, but all of these areas are subject to the larger global climate change processes. So we can be able to tease out, you know, what's us and our human activities versus what's at least larger scale variations due to nature and warming waters. Great. And it's a real biodiversity hotspot as well. So we get a lot of bang for the buck in having a very high number of species across multiple life zones, because, you know, like going up mountains and you go through different life zones, you know, when you drop down through the ocean from relatively shallow continental shelf into the deep ocean, down the sides of the canyons and up the sides of the seamounts, we see many different communities of animals that live in different oceanographic conditions. Great. We also have National Marine Sanctuaries off our coast.
Peter, I apologize. We're about 2 minutes past the break. I just need to put a pause on that for just a moment while we take a quick break. Folks, we're talking with Dr. Peter Oster. He's a senior research scientist at the Mystic Aquarium, as well as a research professor for the Department of Marine Sciences at UConn. We are going to come back as he was poised to talk about, we're going to talk about National Marine Sanctuaries off the East Coast, as well as what folks can do, whether they're going to the shoreline this summer, they're somewhere inland, maybe practicing an activity that might be detrimental to Long Island Sound, even though it's 50, 60, 100 miles away. And we're going to lead off our discussion after the break on an important thing that you can do, and that is restrict your use of plastic. So we'll be back with Dr. Peter Oster in just a moment. Stick with us. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. As adults, many of us are aware that processing grief can be complicated, painful, and a long-term effort. Some of us try therapy, join support groups, or talk to friends to facilitate the healing process. But what can children do, especially those who've experienced great loss and don't have the words or any idea how to deal with their feelings of unbearable grief? Parents or guardians accompany children to the Healing Hearts Center and then gather for separate adult support groups to get help. Children's groups include littles for children 4 to 8, middles for children 9 to 12, and teens for children 13 to 18. The Healing Hearts Center helped almost 100 children over the past year with their compassionate and creative services. The center offers more than 30 different programs, support groups, workshops, and memorial events for children, adult families, and caregivers. And it's the only program of its kind in Western Connecticut. Learn more and get involved or find out how to support these programs at regionalhospiceCT.org. All right. Thanks for hanging around. Peter Oster is with us. He is a senior research scientist at Mystic Aquarium and a research professor for the Department of Marine Sciences at UConn. We're talking about Long Island Sound and its connection and important role it plays to our global ocean network here during June, at the tail end of June, actually, National Ocean Month. So, Peter, you were about to talk about the National Marine Sanctuaries, which reside just off the East Coast here. Tell us a little bit about them.
Sure. So these are sustainable, multiple-use areas. They're not closed to all commercial activities like the Marine National Monument. And these are great places to address questions about human use and balancing human patterns of human use and biodiversity conservation. There's a National Marine Sanctuary at Stellwagen Bank off the coast of Massachusetts. There's one farther down our coast off of Savannah, Georgia, Gray's Reef National Marine Sanctuary, and down off of Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary. So we move from northern latitude to southern latitude or cold, mm-hmm, temperate to subtropical and tropical ecosystems, where we can learn a lot about how we balance sustainable human uses and conservation of biodiversity to deal with all these different stewardship responsibilities we have.
So between the Marine National Monument that we talked about just before the break and these National Marine Sanctuaries, these must play critical roles and must be welcome additions to the kind of global marine venue, if you will, for scientists like yourself and scientists all over the world. It's interesting how I'm sure you as a scientist may be looking at things that are going on in Russia and in Japan and down around Australia, and scientists there are looking at Long Island Sound. It's all part of this National Ocean Month initiative and the kind of work that you do 365 days a year.
Well, so exactly. So the challenge here is looking at ecosystems and communities within them that either behave similarly to different types of human disturbances and natural disturbances, and how some respond differently to those disturbances. So ultimately, the science of ecology will provide guidance for how we might sustainably use these natural resources that we all depend on.
Great. Well, let's give the folks listening some guidance on how virtually everyone can play a role and make a positive difference in not only the health of Long Island Sound, but the entire global ocean network. And in the last 4 minutes or so that we have with you, let's dig into the subject of plastics.
Sure. Well, so hopefully, as people go to the shoreline this summer, I hope they spend a few minutes thinking about our role, our human role as stewards of these places, and that while the ocean looks the same from the surface, whether it's healthy or impacted, we all have a role in ensuring this vibrant future for the oceans and the creatures that live within it. For National Oceans Month is really focused on plastic pollution. 80% of all pollution in the oceans comes from people on land. There's 8 million tons of plastic per year that ends up in the ocean. And I don't mean just the people living, along Long Island Sound, globally.
These are just the bottles tossed in at the beach.
Exactly. And, it wreaks havoc on wildlife and fisheries and tourism. Plastic costs the lives of 1 million seabirds and 100,000 marine mammals each year, based on some United Nations estimates. Fish eat plastic and we eat fish. So the contaminants that stick to the plastics and leach out of the plastics ultimately ends up in us. Whether there's deleterious effects or not in most cases remain to be seen, but we're tossing these things into the food chain. It costs society money, $8 billion in damage to marine ecosystems each year from plastic pollution.
To say nothing of the real cost to recreational and commercial boaters from these massive aircraft carriers and ocean liners, all the way down to the single engine, like little recreational putt-arounds that are going around along shore here in Long Island Sound. When they get wrapped up in these plastics, it can have as much of effect on a boat propeller and drive shaft that's three stories high as it can on one that's about 6 inches tall, right?
Absolutely. Well, in this plastic ends up getting sucked into the cooling systems for these engines, or blocking the filters for these engines. Yeah. So, there's all kinds of real potential problems.
Yeah. Well, we wanted to save a minute for you because just a couple of days ago, as we're taping this and airing it on Sunday, you've got a brand new exhibit up at the Mystic Aquarium that you played
Indeed.
A role in. Tell us about that.
Mystic Aquarium just opened a new exhibit focused on Long Island Sound with a water table touch tank that represents the watershed that drains into the Sound and animals that live within it that children can touch and learn about, so you know they're not scared of things that live in the ocean, but are fascinated and wonder about their lives. There are interactive exhibits for both adults and children. They can learn about species that live in the different habitats that are part of the Long Island Sound ecosystem, from the rivers and the coast to the deep water. And information on restoration and stewardship projects that are happening now and ways that they might get involved.
I guess so, the best way for folks to not only get involved, but to stay involved and get even a heightened level of involvement is to not only come out and see the exhibit at Mystic Aquarium, but become a member of the Mystic Aquarium family, because then you get all kinds of previews and special deals and early access and additional information, emails and newsletters and things. So that's always great. Or if their kids are getting older, hey, consider joining Peter at the Department of Marine Sciences at UConn. They'd be happy to have you if that is something that your young high schooler or even elementary schooler is interested in, possibly as a career.
We're always looking for sharp and motivated students.
Excellent. So it's National Ocean Month here in June, and our brand new go-to authority on it is Dr. Peter Oster, representing the Mystic Aquarium as a senior research scientist as well as a research professor for the Department of Marine Sciences at UConn. Peter, thank you so much. Great to meet you, and can't wait to talk again. It's been way too long since we had a representative of the Small Business Development Center system on the award-winning For the People, and I'm so glad to welcome back Joseph Ercolano, who is the Associate State Director for the Small Business Development Center here today. Excuse the pun, but these guys really are in place to help small business owners and small businesses throughout the state of Connecticut really up their game when it comes to their operations, their personnel, their way of doing business, access to all kinds of resources and funding. We're going to find out all about it. But I will tell you that the SBDC here in Connecticut does provide no-cost advising services to both prospective and existing business owners to help them start or expand their businesses. They're funded through a cooperative agreement with the U.S. Small Business Administration, or SBA, the Connecticut Department of Economic and Community Development, who's a regular fixture here on our program, and the University of Connecticut. We won't steal all of Mr. Ercolano's thunder, and there's a lot more information for him to provide us about the nuts and bolts of the SBDC here in Connecticut and how it works and how it can serve you. So we'll get right into it. Joseph, thank you so much for joining us on the program this morning.
Happy to be here, John. Thank you.
So quickly, just a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in the SBDC here in Connecticut.
Oh, sure. I've been interested and involved in economic and community development for a number of years. I also have some corporate background experience. And this opportunity opened up for me 4 years ago when we built a whole new SBDC team at the University of Connecticut. The SBDC had been in Connecticut for 35 years, at UConn, and then it went over to the Central Connecticut State U location in New Britain, and then back at UConn 4 years ago. So we hired a whole new team, have a lot of great talent in our advising team and our advisors and supportive services, and it was just a perfect fit for, you know, trying to help develop businesses, jobs, and growth in our state. Mm.
And just to continue to evidence the power of networking, I mean, it was just earlier this week that I happened to be at a ribbon-cutting ceremony for a small business in northern Fairfield County when I ran across a great fellow named Nelson who gave me his business card, and we got to talking, mm-hmm. and I said, oh, Small Business Development Center, you guys haven't been on my show for a long time. And he said, oh, well, give me a call and we'll try to do it. And, you know, probably as evidence to how quickly you respond to small businesses, boom, here you are just a few days later, ready to do the program. So kudos to Nelson for making that contact. I see his picture here on your website. So I just wanted to thank him publicly for his assistance in getting us back together again. It's been way too long. So you said you're based up at UConn, but explain to the folks where they can find an SBDC liaison or representative near where their business might be located.
Well, actually, the way we would like people to find us is through our website. We'd mm-hmm. like people to register for advising, which is free, and it's confidential, and there's no strings attached whatsoever. And they could then be contacted, if they register through our website, they'll be contacted by an advisor in their area. And there are 12 of our advisors around the state, every major city, and some of those advisors have multiple offices. Mm. So you might meet with your advisor at a chamber of commerce, or you might meet with them at a local town hall, mm-hmm. Economic development office, or maybe it's, you know, a coffee shop or a restaurant, depending on what the client wants and prefers. We will come to the client. Most of the time, we'll work something out that's convenient to both the advisor and the client. But the quickest way to get us is to go to our website, ctsbdc.com, click on the tab that says Business Advising, and then a button that says Register for Advising, and you're on your way.
Excellent. So it's not a situation where people can just say, oh, I've got a couple hours after I go to the bank. I'm just going to walk in and, you know, it's not counter service, so to speak. It is
More
of a customized one-on-one experience.
That, yeah, that problem with that approach, John, is that, you know, a lot of times our advisors are out working with a client somewhere. So they're not there. Yeah.
Well, the exciting thing is about SBDC is we don't want people who are out there who are owner operators or one man shows or who are creative thinking entrepreneurs that the Small Business Development Center may not be for them. You work, as we said in the intro, with people who even have just a glimmer of an inspiration and the entrepreneurial attitude that you may recognize can make it happen.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And we do rely heavily on some of our partner organizations to help people because, you know, in some instances, we may not be the right assistance that they need at that point in time. Mm-hmm. So we'll, for example, refer a lot of folks to SCORE. And SCORE has a very active presence in Connecticut. I think it's the most active state around in the country for SCORE counselors and workshops, etc. And there's a workshop all the time that someone can go to and begin to test for themselves, is this where I want to head? Do I want to go down the path of owning a business? If they've got a particular type of need that maybe we can help answer, should they register as a LLC, a limited liability corp, or a sole proprietorship, or a C corp, we can help with those questions over the phone. And maybe they don't really need to register for services that directly. Then, of course, we've got other partners who may offer direct technical assistance, organizations like CONSTEP or CERC, that maybe we're not equipped to provide. We're always looking to make a warm handoff so the client can feel like they don't have to make 17 phone calls to get what they really need. We'll try to help them avoid having to do that.
Excellent. It's also really exciting to see that you have some particular expertise if you're approached by veterans, women's, and minority entrepreneurs. But it's also pleasantly shocking to see how young some of your clients have been.
You're right. Exactly. We have, 16-year-old clients, and we have 68-year-old clients. It's all over the map. The baby boomers are still a major force in creating businesses in our country. But having said that, we do encourage and appreciate the opportunity to work with local partners who reach a younger population, and whether it be high school, community college, four-year institutions. We have folks that have been engaged at universities all around the state, not just UConn. We've worked in programs at Fairfield U, University of Bridgeport, Western Connecticut State University, Southern, some of the community colleges, Housatonic and Aspetuck and Manchester Community. Mm. We've been, we try to be where the need is and where people express a desire to work with us. We're there if we can be.
Excellent. Folks, if you just tuned in here, Super Bowl Sunday, we're going to help you score a touchdown or better, win the game if you're a small business person. Joseph Ercolano is with us. He is the Associate State Director for the Small Business Development Centers here in Connecticut. Get started with a relationship with SBDC at ctsbdc.com. And one of the representatives can qualify you for assistance or referral to help you. Whether you're have a glimmer of an idea that may end up being a career, or you're an established business looking to take it to the next level, these programs remain one of the nation's largest small business assistance initiatives in the federal government system, with a proven track record that's almost 35 years strong. So they've got the experience to make it happen for you. And as you're hearing from Joe, if you were with us over the past few minutes, Connecticut has a really robust network incorporating the SBDC, but many other organizations like SCORE to provide help. So you're in a good state and a good place to succeed with all these great supports. So, Joe, let's switch gears and talk about and drill in a little bit more to the range of services that you provide. And what are the most prevalent types of assistance that people are looking for?
I would say by far people come to us looking for help to access capital for growth and expansion. And so what we do is to prepare them for that conversation they need to have with a lender or an investor. So we'll do that by doing some deep dive analysis of their financial statements and their financial situation. We'll talk about their projected revenue or their projected expenses, and help them be able to demonstrate clearly and concisely to a lender that they can afford to pay back a loan they might ask for. It might be a working capital loan. It might be loans to finance acquisition of equipment or real estate. As long as it's tied to a business, we can help them. And just as an example, John, last year our clients were able to raise $54 million in finance, either loan or investment for their businesses. So we can point to that as an indication of the type of thing we help the client work for, work toward. We're really trying to help them achieve the milestones they're trying to achieve.
Okay. Well, the last time I kind of went and looked it up, the kind of alarming statistic was that about one out of every two small businesses or businesses that start up in the United States tend to fail or go out of business within a year or so. I don't know if that is the case here in Connecticut or not, but I'm more interested in finding out from your perspective, how much greater is the challenge or the burden on an individual who is getting started versus a business that kind of may have started and is kind of chugging along, a month in the red, a month in the black, a month very close to the line on either side, and they really want to kind of kick it up to that next level? Let's talk about new startups and new businesses. What are the range of challenges or hurdles that they have to clear in order to set a path toward more likely success?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the first thing that new startups need to do is to really be clear in their minds and on paper, because they have to sometimes share this with others, that what their business model is, how they will make money, who are their customers, what do they, how do they expect to reach those customers, and what kind of revenue do they truly anticipate bringing in the door in year one. Year one is critical because year one establishes both to themselves and to others that this is a viable, sustainable business. Sometimes it may take 2 years to prove or disprove that, but you know, year one is going to be where you begin to build that traction. The challenge for those startups, in addition to be able to clarify their business model, is to finance it. And we have a lot of folks who come to us who are unfortunately not in a position to self-finance to get the doors open and begin to sell something. So it becomes difficult to find people who are willing to take a risk and hand someone money to start up and get some initial sales going. There are programs that will offer some low-cost loans, and there are programs that will be available for folks who are not bankable, if I can use that term in the traditional sense, go into a commercial bank. But, you know, even those programs are looking for a year, minimum of a year of established business bringing in revenue, bringing in money through the door. So those are the biggest challenges that we see, and we do our best to try to, you know, work through the challenges we keep those as best we can. But there's no easy answers, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah. And I think probably one of the saddest things for me, aside from hearing of someone either that I know directly, friend of a friend, someone in the community who's tried to start a business and it has not worked out, is that, you know, they saw something on the internet or they went to a seminar at a hotel or something, and they were convinced that they should go out there and line up a few credit cards and lines of credit and max those credit cards out with cash advances to use that as their investment in themselves, because you know, that's really the only way to get started. Any words of wisdom to individuals who are contemplating that means of funding their startup?
Well, it's not one of those don't ever do it kind of answers. It's really build confidence in your ability to pay yourself back by taking it slowly, and don't over invest in things that really don't help you test your product assumption. So, you know, one of the great examples that we use in some of our workshops is the story of Zappos, where the gentleman who started Zappos back in the late 90s wasn't sure people would buy shoes online. But instead of building a warehouse and stocking it with thousands of pairs of shoes, he simply went down the street to a couple of local shoe stores and said, I'd like to take a picture of these shoes. If I sell them online, I'll come back and buy them from you. And that's what he did. Mm. And he proved to himself that, yes, there is a market to sell shoes online. It was a low-cost investment, not a lot of overhead. He still had to begin to build out a website and an ordering system and a shopping cart on his website, and he had to deal with customer service and customer returns. But he was able to take that step by step and not have to come up with, you know, $2 million of initial investment. I don't know what his initial investment was, but it was certainly, you know, a small fraction of that.
And certainly,
so we try to give that kind of advice of, you know, if you are going to self-finance, see if you can avoid jumping in with both feet.
not to pick up on that about following in his footsteps, but there has certainly been a million other online clothing and accessory retailers that have followed that formula and saw some success.
Exactly.
As well, before we have to let you go, Joe Ercolano, tell me, I mean, the other exciting thing about the Small Business Development Center is that it partners with the power of UConn. Just before we close, tell us where UConn fits into your program.
Well, it's exciting to be part of UConn. There's so much going on in the area of business and big in analytics and digital media. And, you know, we are able to tap into very knowledgeable people, understand, you know, how we can help them sometimes bring their research to a commercial setting. And we've worked with everything from professors to graduate students who work directly with our clients on an internship basis. We can't do that for every client, unfortunately, but we've been able to begin to assist in ways we never thought we could by linking our clients to very talented, very experienced grad students and even some undergrads who bring some new perspective or maybe bring some just manpower to the table that our clients can't provide on their own. So we're excited about UConn. It's a real great, great opportunity for us to bring that to the community and to give back to the school as well.
Right, and it gives the business a little bit of sense of what how their creation or invention or idea is perceived by a younger demographic market equipped with the educational and practical expertise to kind of give them information through the eyes of someone they might not otherwise be able to get it from, which is highly valuable and sought after by any business, from the big global conglomerates on down to the little in-home entrepreneurial effort. So fantastic. Yeah. Great to talk to you. We could go on for a much longer time, and I hope we get a chance to do that again soon, because it's been too long since the SBDC has been a guest on the show. Joseph Arcolano, sure. Great to make your acquaintance. He's Associate State Director of the Connecticut Small Business Development Centers, providing no-cost advising services to both prospective and existing business owners, from teens to octogenarians almost, to help them start or expand their businesses. CTSBDC.com. CTSBDC.com is where it all starts for you, whether you're just coming up with an idea or you're an existing business that's ready to help. Joe, great to meet you and make your acquaintance. Thank you for being with us this morning, and have a great Super Bowl. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for airtime in writing to me via email at john.voket, that's john.voket, at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast without permission of Connoisseur Media. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voket. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and important information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.